Hello, motion picture brains. That's you. Bands of light, darkness, composition, celluloid, zeros and ones. Welcome back to episode 3 of the Through the Lens podcast, the unedited audio of our full conversation with one of the world's most dynamic cinematographers. In this episode, we spoke with the gracious Dean Cundey, known for, amongst other things, the films of, Halloween 2, The Thing, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Back to the Future, Jurassic Park, Apollo 13, do I need to keep talking? Do I? The man shot Back to the Future. All three of them. It's Dean freaking Cundey, dude. Like, the guy. Like, if this were a concert, this isn't some cover band, this is actually the real band. Do you get what I'm saying? What follows is the uncut audio of my conversation with Dean. We met him, as it should be noted, after a long day of shooting for him in New Haven, Connecticut, at the Omni Hotel in October of 2012. Thanks go out to the Omni Hotel. You'll notice when you listen to this about 300 interruptions from passersby as we shot in the middle of the lobby. If you want to check out the Hollywood video version of this interview, and I know you do, you will find it at crafttrek.com as Season 1, Episodes 3 and 4 of Through the Lens.
We split it up.
Or you can go to youtube.com/crafttruck. You can also subscribe if you are just in that mood. It should be noted that during this interview, Dean was actually knighted by the Queen.
So was Halloween like the first major thing that like you got
Yeah, I had done maybe a dozen low-budget action films and stuff.
Right.
Nobody was doing horror at that time, so they were action films. And
nobody was doing horror in the late 70s?
No. Halloween started
well,
the trend.
When you look in the annals of horror movie history,
uh-huh.
You got... those are our extras, by the way.
Yeah.
We paid. Yeah. Can you guys go back to ones?
Yeah.
we're here. I just introduced just so that we can. By the way, we can cut things out of sequence and stuff like that. So
right.
We're going to make it look like the limey by the time we're done. It's
going
to be out.
Very
but
good.
We're here in the in King Edward's castle, which has been graciously moved brick by brick to New Haven, Connecticut, where we're actually nowhere near the set of Mr. Dean Cundey's latest film. One of the greatest, simply put, one of the greatest cinematographers in the history of the medium, a man who's been able to work consistently at all scales, large and small, and has shot some of the greatest films ever made. Thank you for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure, especially after that intro. Yeah, I just wish you could tell that to my wife.
Give her her email and I'll send it right over. Let her know.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, your husband's a genius. So I'm sure she knows. So Halloween comes up. How does it come? I mean, first of all, what are you doing before Halloween? You've got a series of pictures, a host of pictures. Let me get that iPad back again so I can look at you've already done at this point. You've already done a bunch of pictures, but none of them is necessarily like a huge...
No, I did Where the Red Fern Grows, which was kind of an accepted movie, a book that every junior high school kid had to read, so it had some credibility, but it was, kind of a smallish hit.
Right.
But I had also at that time been doing Satan's Cheerleaders.
Yeah.
Which
was,
let me see.
That sounds like a very straight drama.
It was. It was a little meaningful family film.
Right. meaningful family.
And I was doing, Seven from Heaven and a whole variety of B films,
okay.
B movies that were for the drive-in theaters because back in those days they still had drive-in theaters.
And you're saying nobody, when you say nobody was doing horror movies, the end of the late 70s, is it because it was a genre that people still associated with a theremin and with...
Exactly. Nobody had sort of reinvented it as John Carpenter did,
right.
And Deborah, as a you know, it, they've now become slasher films.
Right.
But
in fact, that's what they'll do when they break down genres into subgenres. They'll separate between slasher and thriller or whatever. You know,
right. So now they do the slasher films in it, but Halloween had no blood. We made a very concerted effort to not have blood in it, just to make a suspenseful, a new run at horror and thriller and all of that.
So how does it work? Tell us about how you got the script and if you thought, one of the people we've interviewed is Dave Armstrong, shot Saw.
Mm-hmm.
He said that when he got this script, he knew that this would put him on the mat, or there was something special in the script, right?
Well, I'd have to say that I'd been doing a dozen different, action films, but I came out of a desire to be a visual storyteller.
Right.
I had studied production design, graphics, and stuff, so I was very visually oriented. And a lot of the early films I was doing were low budget, very small schedules.
Right.
And so it was a case of using the camera to record the actors talking.
Right.
And then we'd use the camera to record some cars blowing up.
Right.
And
then you'd cut them together.
Yeah, and it would be cut together. And, but it was hard because of the short schedules and also the sort of aesthetic limitations to do anything, visually interesting.
Right.
I used the films for my own selfish purposes to learn how to make films. Schedules, how do you light a room with only three lights? I would challenge myself, something like that. And I had done, I guess, three or four films that Deborah Hill had been the script supervisor on.
And it was actually the script supervisor that introduced you to...
Yeah, so, and that's one of the things I find interesting about this business is that so much of, especially your early career. One of the things I mentioned to film students and aspiring filmmakers is the fact that so much of your career is through networking.
Yes.
Doing a job that's 110%.
Yep.
You always give more than they expect, and somebody will notice. And the production manager recommends you to a producer, I worked on a film where the production assistant, this young kid, kept coming up and asking me, so how come you put that, why did you make the decision to do this or that? And they were intelligent questions. So I answered them to the best of my ability. And he sort of appreciated that. But it turns out that he was the writer on a film that was going to be made right afterwards. He recommended me to the director, and that's how I got the job, because a production assistant hired me.
Got it.
The script supervisor hired me on Halloween. Deborah went to John and then came to me and suggested that we might be a good team, that we had similar sensibilities, and which I thought was pretty cool. And so I met John, and, we hit it off. And I was delighted to discover that John was a great visual storyteller, that he was interested in using the camera, composition, lighting, all the stuff, to the same extent that I was, to create mood and emotional response in the audience. And so it turned into a great adventure for me, a great result, because it was a movie that was more than the sum of its parts.
Right.
And so I really enjoyed the fact that, here was a director, and a new young director, who wanted to do something that I really enjoyed and appreciated. So Halloween was the calling card for both of us, a variety of us.
And it did phenomenal at the box office. Like it was
yeah, well, eventually. Yeah. The first week it opened, it was brand new. Nobody had seen that kind
anything
of
like
thriller horror yeah. film. And it did just modest business. And everybody said, oh, well, I guess that's it. You know, we made the wrong kind of movie. The second week it was out, it did better. Word of mouth was spreading. The third week, even better.
So this is something that never happens
yeah,
anymore.
Yeah, you know, so a low-budget film. And it, in fact, became the highest grossing dollar for dollar in, for dollar out of, you know, any of the low-budget or independent films. You know,
right.
it made a fortune over a long period of time. It's still playing. It's playing down the street in about 2 weeks from where we're shooting here now.
Let's talk a little bit about the actual photography in the mm-hmm. movie, because it is so, you know, there's a few sequences that you can't, once you've seen the movie, you can't forget.
Mm-hmm.
You don't forget. The opening sequence, as Michael as a child is slowly hunting down his own sister and killing her, moving around the house in and out of the, and then finally we sort of pull out to see this kid who's been our POV, and black pools under his eyes, mm-hmm. you know, with the parents standing there, if I'm not mistaken, is all this in one shot or were there some hidden edits in there?
No, yeah, well, there's one hidden edit, but we shot it all in one shot.
Okay, so you took the part one from one take and one from the other. And
yeah, it was, and that was really just sort of to blend together, you know, two takes, one that had a better beginning and one that had a better ending.
But did you yourself operate that shot?
Yeah, we shared. It was a new camera at the time, the Panaglide, camera support system. The Panaglide, which was the equivalent of the Steadicam,
right.
which is such a, it's a very ubiquitous tool now.
Now, yeah.
But at the time, it was used once for, you know, with moving through a crowd of people.
Right.
Where a conventional dolly with wheels wouldn't be able to go, because,
right.
but nobody had yet, you know, sort of explored the potential for it. Well,
right.
John saw it as a great way to do, you know, the visual storytelling, and you know, I concurred completely.
Did you know that you were going to be from the POV of Michael?
Yeah, we had talked about it, and we. You know, had extensive conversation about what's the best way, and holding the camera handheld is effective in some ways, but we were looking for a way for the camera to, you know, glide through the scenes and the you know, the story. So it seemed the obvious answer, and I had done I had used it a couple times.
Right.
And my operator, Ray Stella, had also learned to use it. We were essentially self-taught at that point. Now there are classes and a lot of Steadicam operators who are really good, but we were, you know, just learning.
As far as the lighting of the sequence is concerned, were you pushing yourself to go dark, you know, like going to the edge of danger in terms of exposure, or was it...
Yeah, it was, and that sequence in particular was interesting because the camera moves through the house, through the backyard, and through the house in one direction, and then comes out another. And we would look through the window of
right.
the house and into a room. And the camera would then walk into that same room, but looking, you know, the other direction. The bottom line being that hiding the lights was very tricky. We would light the room in one direction, and then when the camera came in the other way, you had to remove the lights that were in the shot.
You actually had grips.
So, yeah, we had, you know, we would start up under the porch into the room, look into the room that we had lit in a particular way, hiding the lights, you know, out of sight, through the house, and then by the time the camera came into that room, for instance, the front room, the living room where the kids are watching TV, all of those lights had to be moved, some of them taken out. So it was amusing to to hear the shot being done, because we would glide up, we'd look through the window, and then the camera would move on, and I could hear the guys.
All the guys moving lights.
Say, okay, get that one. Unplug it. No, unplug it. You know.
But now the funny thing is that because the whole sequence is made up so much, it's not. I mean, I don't want to say the performance didn't matter, but you've got the sister, you know, getting busy with her boyfriend in the other room.
Right.
To use a really antiquated term that even by today's standards makes me sound like a major nerd, but whatever. And then basically the rest of it is all just, it's all camera, you know? I mean, like, you do finish on the boy, but it's a sequence made haunting by the use of camera and light and space.
And, again, that's what I, you know, really appreciated about film in general, but working with John was the fact that he was interested in that as much as I was, you know, possibly more so. So he was very encouraging from that standpoint. And the fact that, you know, he gave me a lot of freedom to do the lighting and collaborate with him on cameras and setups and, you know, lenses and all that stuff. So, you know, the film was a milestone for several reasons. One, the box office. Two, it started a new genre. And three, it gave me and John credibility in that we, you know, we made a film that somebody heard of, you know, that was a box office success. So when that happens, suddenly you've got the credibility to work on, you know, other
bigger
people's
pictures.
Bigger movies, right?
Right.
And of course, he and Deborah and all had the credibility to do another film with, you know, a slightly larger budget.
Right, which we'll talk about in a second.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing I want to ask about with Halloween, the shot over the shoulder of Michael as he's driving some sedan following Jamie Lee Curtis as she's walking home from school, it's just one of the scariest. Like, you could be sitting in the theater, you could walk into the movie at that point, and it's frightening. Why is that? What was it about that?
Well, it was a very sort of voyeuristic film, obviously.
Right.
You know, we were watching as an audience. And then sometimes we were Michael Myers watching as, you know, the killer. So you didn't quite know which one you were. But it was, you know, to a certain extent you could identify with
Michael,
you know, at least, and not from a personality standpoint, because he has essentially no real personality other than pure evil, as he's described. But
by Donald Pleasance.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But you know, he, you know, was such an obvious threat, and which was one of those things that I think John and I subsequently learned, is that how do you make a character a threat? John always had this theory that as the audience, you shouldn't become the POV of the monster, because you, you know, and sometimes, you know, the camera on cheap movies and still, it moves and looks through the bushes and stuff, and suddenly you are the monster. And it's odd for an audience to become the monster and yet be afraid of it as a killer, as whatever. So it was a very delicate balance between implying that you were, you know,
the killer,
and
still
or you know, more correctly, I would say, is that you were lurking outside with
the killer,
next
over
to the killer.
Yeah.
You know, so there was always the presence, but you were not the...
You're not safe.
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
You know,
it's
so
interesting, because at the end of that shot, he sort of drives off and past, and it sort of pulls back to show more of Michael driving.
Right.
And at that point, you are, you know, you're unable to control him. You know, he's peaking, you're peaking, but then at the end of that shot, it drives off, and, you know, you're like, well, I'm not driving this car. He is. Mm-hmm. And right. I don't know what he's going to do.
Right.
I have to ask because it is one of the greatest images in cinema history. The closet, the light pouring in, the hand tearing away at the wooden slats.
Mm-hmm.
Did you when you were making that, were you just looking through the lens going, wow, this is going to scare the shit out of people, or was it more just?
Well, it's interesting because as a maker of thrillers, horror,
yep,
whatever you'd call them, you sort of learn the mechanics. You think about how do you scare the
right.
audience,
right?
The third time, in other words,
or the fifth time, yeah.
Yeah, they go to the closet and there's the sound, and they go and they open and the cat jumps out, right?
Right.
How many times have we seen that?
Right.
Right. And there's this startle, and then, you know, the audience goes, oh, it's only the cat. And then the character turns, and there's the killer. You know, so it's like a red herring, as we would call it. And, you know, so there's certain mechanical things that we know sort of work. And it was a case of being able to see that and develop it. But when I go see a horror film, you know, if you were a magician,
right,
as I was as a kid,
right,
and you stood backstage,
right,
you would say, oh yeah, well, there's a guy running into the other box, and they're using the, so horror films, it's kind of the same for me, you know, you know the tricks and stuff, so I don't get scared once in a while, but.
Can you name any movies recently that scared you, by the way?
No, actually, I can't recently. But mm-hmm.
What did you feel when you saw The Exorcist, for example? I'm just picking something out of my head.
Well, there were certain movies, even as a kid.
Yeah.
I think I was aware of, because I wanted to be
a filmmaker.
In film.
Yeah.
Since I was in, well, elementary school, but certainly high school. And so I, you know, you sort of watch a film and say, oh, I see what they're doing. The camera's this and a trick here, and oh, he's going to scare us now. And yes, he did. But, you know, over a period of time as a kid, you know, you sort of learn the tricks. There were very few films that scared me except The Body Snatchers, the Kevin McCarthy movie,
yep,
with the aliens,
yep,
and the pod, and it foamed up and... As a kid, I was probably 12 years old. I remember waking up in the middle of the night.
Terrified.
There was a pod in my room, and it was going to take over my brain. And what? Oh, wait. Oh, no. Well, that was stupid of me to put my coat on the floor. You know, that kind of stuff.
That's
so, but there weren't very many films that scared me because, right, you know, you get sort of used to the tricks. And... you know, so, you know, as we were making Halloween, you just sort of say, oh, well, that should be an interesting shot. Oh, yeah, and when combined with that, so the closet sequence, you know, with the breaking the things and one of my, you know, kind of favorite things is Jamie Lee upstairs. She thinks she's safe. She's,
yep.
And slowly, Michael Myers becomes visible in the closet next to her.
Right.
And that was a case of, you know, John saying, well, how can we make it so that we can't see him? And then it seems like our eyes are getting used to the dark, right? Mm-hmm. And we see. So I had a little light with a snoot, which is something that confines it just to a very small spot, on a dimmer. And so I lit it dark enough so you couldn't see Michael in the closet, and then just slowly brought the dimmer up till he became visible. And, wow. And you know, the audience, who is concentrating on Jamie Lee and not seeing anything in the closet, suddenly becomes aware of the fact that he's lurking there.
Right.
And You know, so those are the
kind of... And that just, when you saw it in the theater with an audience, probably just...
Oh, yeah. They were, you know, because you can hear an audience react. That's the fun part, is when the audience reacts to a film you're working on. And, and they would, you know, just be this intake of breath and this, oh, no, and this, oh, look out, and, you know. So...
Fantastic.
Those are the kind of fun things to create something like that and see how it works.
So let's jump forward a bit. So... Okay, so we're jumping forward, and you go to make a movie that is on many people's scariest... I mean, Halloween is unquestionably an epic horror film, a scary movie that changed the game. But The Thing is on many people's lists of the scariest movies ever made in a different way, in a very different way.
Right.
You know, right from the beginning... This helicopter flying over, chasing down this dog, which is the ultimate, you know, the screenwriters will tell you, you know, you want to make your character sympathetic, have them be nice to an animal, to a dog or a cat or something like that, you know. And here at the beginning of the movie, this guy's trying to gun down a dog, and we don't know why.
No, he's obviously a bad man.
He's obviously a bad man. Exactly.
Yeah, who would want to kill a poor dog?
Right. And yet the music is letting us know that something is amiss.
Right.
So, we're, you know, just tell us about, I mean, because this movie is extremely dark. There are some scenes in there, even when the dog, self-same dog's head finally explodes, and the tongue is waggling around. By the way, I'm going from memory because I will never get that shot out of my head. And it reaches up, this monster reaches up and pulls itself into the sub-ceiling or the attic. You can barely see. You see enough to get the shit scared out of you. But you know. So, can you tell us a little bit about shooting the movie, about what you wanted to do photographically?
Well, Rob Bottin, was a great influence on it because he was doing such unusual creature stuff.
Right.
It was somewhere between makeup and special effects. You know, he was sculpting. Creating things that moved, you know, it was, you know, makeup and special effects. And so a lot of what he was doing was so unique, hadn't been done before. You know, we have seen, you know, from the 50s and 60s, aliens and creatures and creatures from black lagoons and all kinds of...
Swamp things.
Yeah. And usually they're sort of out in the open.
Right.
You know, they, when they're conceived of by the filmmakers, they are just mutant creatures that are after you.
Right.
The idea was to create the illusion that this thing can transform and mutate, and you never know what it's going to do and what form it's going to take and which one of the guys could be it and why is the dog and all of the... questions it asks and poses. So the idea was to show just enough of Rob's creations without making you aware of the rubber and the paint and the seams and all of that, because, and especially at the time, it was all physical. Now you can create all kinds of things in computers and make them look however you want and light them however you want. In those days, they had to work in front of the camera.
Right.
And you had to light it.
Right.
You know, there was nothing that appeared on film that wasn't lit.
Right.
Or unlit.
Right.
So it was that was the case of adapting to that. So how do you create the environment for sketchy lighting and so forth? How do you create the mood of this, you know, place where they're living in the Antarctic, and how do you tie it all together and make it seem plausible and yet, you know, get them to believe the implausible?
Right.
And one of the rules that I'd always heard and adhere to is that if you want the audience to believe the impossible, you have to give them as much possible as possible, if you see where I'm going with this.
Yep, the best lie is sandwiched between two truths.
Exactly.
Right.
So, you know, if the audience accepts all of the other rules of the impossible, physics, gravity, you know, light and shadow, whatever.
Yep. Temperature.
Temperature. Then you can, you know, get them to, for the suspension of disbelief becomes, you know,
possible.
So the idea was to create an environment that these guys live in that allowed for darkness, that allowed for lights going out
right.
and being, you know, hiding
yeah.
the stuff, you know, and the environment where they were essentially trapped,
right.
you know,
yeah.
and
well, they're marooned by virtue of the surroundings.
Exactly, you know, yeah. You can't go anywhere. And it was intriguing to me because we shot the helicopter stuff. And the dog being chased and, you know, some things like that, the first. And we did it outside of Juneau, Alaska, where we were flown by helicopter to a glacier research camp. These wooden huts on top of a rock outcropping. And there were various universities and scientific organizations that would use it to research the glacier. And down below was a very slow-moving glacier. They had rods in it, you know, and they would to check the movement and uh-huh. things like that. So we lived in an environment that was very similar.
Uh-huh.
And it was intriguing to me because, you know, we were stuck there. We couldn't go anywhere. The helicopter had to come to take us away.
Did this affect the picture?
I think it did because, first of all, the key crew came along. We were in this environment where the only thing was there was a small library, and you could go read a book. But other than that, yeah, we didn't have...
All work and no play makes Dean a dull boy?
Well, you know, there were things like signs and symptoms of cabin fever.
Oh, Gewalt.
And, you know, psychology books. And then all of the scientific, you know, the glacial slide and how it can be measured, you know. So it was this, you know, very sort of semi-eclectic but aimed at the environment. And there was no satellite dish. There was a radio that on good days could be relayed from another guy to another guy to Juneau. So we were very isolated. And I think it certainly gave us all an understanding of
right.
what it is. And there's, you know, funny things that happen, you know, the way we were told that cabin fever, there are guys that would be, working in the Antarctic.
Right.
And if they didn't have a routine, right, breakfast at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, clean the frivets, right, 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock, you have an hour to yourself. 12 o'clock is lunch, you know, so...
You actually structured this.
Yeah, this we didn't do this, but this is...
Psychiatrist.
Yeah, they, and because they say when you're left to your own devices and you don't have something you have to do and things to fulfill, the guys would get antsy. And pretty soon, cabin fever would come in, which was this oppressive feeling that you were trapped and, you know, so they say there would be symptoms at first like, you took my socks.
Oh, really?
No, I didn't. No.
But did you see this happen?
You're wearing my socks. No, I'm not. You know, well, no, we didn't. You know, because we were there a short time, and we had a routine, and you know.
Right.
But so this is it. I can't take this anymore.
Right.
You stole my socks. I'm leaving here.
Right.
And they would go out and they'd try to walk home from the Antarctic to Cleveland or wherever. And if they weren't recovered, they would die out in the snow because your mind, you know, just does goofy things.
Starts to trick.
Yeah, well, so, you know, living through that, we applied that to...
To the movie.
To the movie, to the
okay.
characters, to the environment, to the lighting, to everything. How do you make it, you know, sort of an oppressive... And now you throw into the mix all this suspicion... That not you, no, you didn't take my socks. You're
a monster.
You're the creature.
Right.
So, you know, it's a very sort of real examination of human stuff.
It's funny because in some ways it's the science fiction version of the Treasure of Sierra Madre. Mm-hmm. You know, like the experiment in the psychology of men when they're locked together in a situation that's too tense.
Mm-hmm.
It's a phenomenal picture. It remains today. Netflix. Just happened to cruise by before we knew we were going to be interviewing you. Mm-hmm. Several months. Just pull it on. The sound takes over the opening, and you're just completely engrossed in it. It's a wonderful, wonderful picture. Did that element of cabin fever that you're just talking about, and this how it influenced? Did that affect the writing, John's writing of the last line? We'll wait here for a bit, see what happens.
I think probably so. I mean, it certainly gave credibility to what he was writing and an understanding, so anything we did was tempered by our understanding of this, and I'm sure that he did the same with the writing and the implementing the story.
How did you achieve the special effect? I mean, the greatest special effect in the movie, in my mind, is the blood sample hot needle exchange, for several reasons. One, because it's so simple and small, and two, because the minute that effect happens, you're scared out of your mind, but then of course the flamethrower starts to backfire because it's been using it to warm the needle.
Right.
And now there's this monster starting to shake and transform. And you're sitting there like, shoot the fucking thing, and you can't, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
sir.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's so nice to hear these behind the thing about finding out behind the scenes stuff is it never is what you would expect. It's always, it's always another angle on something, whether it's the actor's take on what happened or whatever.
Well, and what we do is so technical.
I know.
With lighting and things, how many foot candles and all. To me, sometimes that can be just oppressive and boring to an audience. It's more about, the stories of how we did it and all that stuff.
Rolling? Okay. So the sequence with the hot needle and the blood jumping, I have a few questions about it. First of all, how did he make that effect happen? Because it really does look like this pool of blood is jumping away out of this petri dish.
I'd have to look at it again, but I think it's sort of a classic film illusion, which is you build the suspense with each, the hot needle and...
Right.
And, okay, this guy's not it. And this guy... now you're starting to think, when is it going to happen? Which one of these guys have got to be it? We don't know who it is. I did a little bit of a trick with David, the guy who, is the one. Everybody else, I put in what they call an eye light. It's a very small little bit of light, but it reflects in the eye, and it makes that highlight, that point of white, that gives life to the eyes. And it's a very deliberate thing that we do to allow you to understand the emotion of an actor, a character. Well, with David, I deliberately eliminated the eye light to give him these sort of dead eyes. So
that's a sneaky trick.
Yeah. So, it's one of those things that if you go back and look, you'll realize that his eyes are different than everybody else's. A subtle thing, very few people notice it, but it's one of those...
Subconsciously, it will affect the viewer.
Yeah, exactly, because, you're looking for the life in the eyes, and his eyes are dead.
Right.
So, little subconscious things like that. But the effect of the thing, I'd have to go back and look, because it seemed to me it was pretty simple. A lot of it was in the editing.
Right.
We built an upside down room. so that when David clings to the ceiling, right, goes up and clings to the ceiling, we are, in fact, looking at the floor of a room, and we build it upside down, and we hung the lamps on the ceiling, we hung them so that they stuck straight up, turned the camera upside down,
And now the other effect of a guy literally jumping to the ceiling.
Yeah, so
when
he
was falling, boom, to it.
When, in fact, he was just dropping falling onto the floor.
Was that your little idea? Or?
I don't know if it was. You know, there's so much of that stuff is collaborative.
Right.
There's the famous sequence with Fred Astaire dancing all around the room in whatever that movie was.
Yeah. we'll cut, just do this for a few seconds.
Mm-hmm.
We'll just get you recording. Yeah, we're not American Imperial. You know what, Alexis? I have your phone. She can't.
Oh yeah. No. It was Royal Wedding, I think it is.
Yes.
But, and they built a room that rotated, and then they fastened the lights to it, and Fred Astaire does this amazing dance routine, and the camera is fastened to the room. So as the room turns upside down, the camera does too. So it always looks like the room is right side up, but in fact he dances up one wall and up to the ceiling, and so he makes all these transitions that are very, very clever.
He stole that. And
so we stole that idea from a happy-go-lucky musical to making a classic moment in a horror film.
It's also not dissimilar from Richard Donner trying to figure out how to get the woman to fall. So he did it on a wall. Just had her sort of spin around towards the wall and put the egg on the... Anyway, just reminding me of that. You said a lot of it was editing, and my next question was actually, what was it like when you finally saw that sequence cut together? Was it? Do you have the pleasure of coming in and going, "Wow, this is really great to see this," cut
that,
together?
There are certain people who are your friend. As a cinematographer, you rely on certain people: the production designer to provide sets and environments that you can light or make look good.
Yep.
You sort of go hand in hand. A production designer can create stuff that you have no chance of lighting or making look good. On the other hand, you can also ruin, as a cinematographer, you can ruin the work of a production designer by lighting it flatly or not bringing out the textures and shapes and all of that stuff. So, and then the editor. Providing the pieces...
These are all paid performers.
Yeah.
These are now not extras anymore. These are actually principals now.
Just
the
back.
Oh, yes. Hey, how are you? Who was that? So, that was the director.
I know.
Yeah.
We met him really.
Oh, good.
He's Australian.
Yeah. So, the editor is also your friend.
Right.
Or your enemy. And you are the friend or enemy of the editor. If you don't provide him with
the material
and the right pieces and the ability to cut it together with the right timing and, storytelling that the editor does, then, you're not his friend anymore. And if he, doesn't cut together the brilliant things that you as a cinematographer have accomplished,
right,
then he can ruin,
your work.
My work and essentially the movie, So the three of us are really the custodians of the visual image and the visual storytelling.
Right.
And so I always have thought of everything I have done, and especially when I collaborate with a director, how do you provide the pieces that are going to be used and effective for the editor, and also how do you provide the pieces and that are that show off the production designer's work and the environments that that he's using to create the mood and the the world of the characters. So the thing was an example of John being also very aware of editing. and the pieces that are necessary. And myself, you know, hopefully, you know, helping out with that by providing, you know, the camera angles and the lighting and stuff that, that help out on both those, the production designer and the editor's part. And, you know, the thing was a great exercise in that.
And when you finally saw the sequence, was it just like, were you just thrilled? Or?
Yeah, there were several sequences that were, you know, that really sort of came together, that all the right pieces were put together in the right order with the right timing, and that was one of them that, you know, created the tension, the suspense, and then the dramatic payoff.
Well, it is such a tremendous film. So, what's interesting is the industry typically, particularly the studios, the executives, they want to pigeonhole everybody who works in the business to a certain degree. There's this desire to say, you know, oh, you know, such and such a photographer, you know, has he shot 1 hour television? No, only half hour television. Well, that's just not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Have they shot, you know, this type of a, you know, I've heard tons of horror stories about this. You know, I've seen it. You move from these, you know, you said you did action, and you're known for doing these horror movies now. Halloween, Halloween 2, The Thing. And then you get on to Back to the Future, which I'm assuming was 1985 because it's forever imprinted in our minds.
Right.
Was there any resistance from the studio or from anyone about, you know, or was it because it was such a warped concept, you know, that with so much, you know, interesting darkness to it and, you know, lightning at the end that...
Yeah, I think that your previous resume, your filmography, what you've done and the styles and stuff always help, especially if you're dealing with, you know, producers and executives and stuff who have seen those. I've actually, a couple of times, I did a couple of comedies and things like that, and I had applied for a job, you know, or going to be interviewed for a job that was a dark suspense thing. And people said, well, at the time they said, well, he's done these comedies and things, but this is a suspense thriller, you know. Can he really do that? And they had to say, well, have you ever seen Halloween?
They actually had to bring that up.
Exactly. You know, because unless the IMDb now makes it easy to do that. But until then, they relied on you to provide the filmography, and if they didn't have one or the agent hadn't included something, right? So, you know, you weren't always accurately, you know, represented. But... you know, in my case, I had worked with Bob Zemeckis on Romancing the Stone.
Right.
And then Bob came to me.
Which is also a masterpiece we can talk about a little bit.
And Bob came to me and said, you know, I'm going to do this thing that, that Spielberg is, you know, sort of fostering.
EP. Yep.
And it's an unusual kind of fantasy thing. You know, are you in? And I said, well, of course. And, you know, you read it, and it was such an unusual take on time travel. You know, they had been saying to Bob, again, pigeonholing, it's a time travel movie. They don't do very well, you know, because they were referencing.
They don't do very well.
They were referencing the last time travel movie that was done, whatever it was.
Right.
And it probably, you know, hadn't been a big success, so of course movies, as well as the people who make them, get pigeonholed.
Right.
Oh, people don't go see a Western, right?
Right.
Well, why would you want to make a pirate movie?
Right.
People don't go see it. And then you make a pirate movie that does appeal, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean or whatever.
Right.
So it was the same with time travel. And we said, no, 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 this is different time travel. This is accessible to people. It's not in the future, and it's not
it's not existential.
No, it's not a machine that takes you somewhere, and you know, it's all about scientific something. This is about something we've all dreamed about, going back and fixing something we thought wasn't right, only to discover that we really should.
What is it you're talking about? What are you talking about? Are you a big DP?
I'm getting.
Are you the DP?
I'm
you're the only one I care about.
I hear voices. I hear the voices.
It's all in your
They're telling me.
You're talking about cabin fever earlier. It's all,
yeah.
No, it's
yeah.
Really
Who was that?
Ladies and gentlemen,
Mr.
Cuba Gooding Jr.
Yeah.
And Mr.
Tierra is his.
Tierra Cruz.
Yeah, his stunt guy and our stunt coordinator and so forth on this particular epic. But I digress.
Yes.
Or they did.
They digress. Yeah.
So where was I? Oh yes. So it was a movie that was, a whole different take on time travel, and we sensed that was something that was going to, you know, be appealing because it was accessible to an audience.
Right.
Proven to be true because, you know, people still remember it.
When you read the script,
mm-hmm.
did you say to yourself, this is the most perfectly structured screenplay I've ever read? Because I can say, without a shadow of a doubt, that, you're teaching somebody wants to know about screenwriting. They want to know, Star Wars, maybe Chinatown, Back to the Future, this mm-hmm. is a perfectly structured screenplay that's used all the time as being, the payoff mm-hmm. at the end of this movie. First, he manages to save his parents, mm-hmm. which leads him to rushing to go mm-hmm. and get Back to the Future, which leads him to going and trying and save Doc, and then we find out that his life has turned right around.
Mm-hmm.
It is just so bang, bang, bang. I mean...
Well, yes, at the time, I marveled, and a lot of people marveled, at the fact that it was so tightly written, so well conceived.
Yes.
Everything had been thought about and how it interlinked with this and that. It was a case of, if you watched the movie or read the script, you would say, well, wait, what about, this would have, oh, wait, they did solve that. Oh, this.
Everything is paid off.
Right. So, it was interesting that the original script that Bob and Bob had written was, a few years before. And it was actually very interesting because the layers that we didn't do, and probably thankfully now, was the fact that that Marty goes back and gives Doc Brown a few hints.
Right,
about technology and so forth. And what occurs is Doc invents some things, becomes a big successful guy in science and industrial design or, technology, whatever. And the future, or the present, that Marty goes to, is the same one that I remember in Popular Mechanics magazine in the 50s and 60s, which is, by now, we're all in flying cars.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And by now, we could teleport, and, all of the technology that they claimed was going to happen back in the 50s, Doc has made it come true. So Marty comes back to a present, or back to the future, to a world that has all of that, and it's been completely changed, and now he's got to go back and, and tell Doc lies so that he doesn't, change. Because, as he's told, Doc very wisely says, no, you can't change anything here because it's going to ripple effect all the way down to the future and change everything.
Right.
So that was the script that they had written, and it was, you know, it was going to be considerably more expensive, you know. So they opted for, you know, a little more direct approach to Marty coming back, and he's improved his future.
So is that what led to Back to the Future 2? Is that finally, was basically taking, unearthing these things that they wanted to put in the original script?
I think so. And interesting, because Back to the Future 2 and 3 were originally one script.
Yeah, you shot them back to back, right?
And, yeah, they said, well, we can't, it's too long and too expensive. So how do we fix that? Well, we'll take this out.
Right.
Well, because it was so well constructed, you take that out, it affects this. So wait, okay, so now we'll change this. Oh, that's not logical for that. So by the time they tried to shorten Back to the Future 2, it screwed up everything.
Right.
So finally, I think it was Kathy Kennedy said, well, it seems obvious. Why don't we make it Back to the Future 2 and 3? And we will get two movies for the price of 1.5.
And we'll all get paid a little more.
Well,
not a bad thing.
Yeah. I don't remember that part. But, you know, so it was a case of, you know, trying to keep the integrity of this very, very carefully crafted story. Well, Back to the Future 2 is a darker version, but it was necessary for the journey to get to 3, the Old West and the happy ending. And I think that people didn't realize at the time that they really had to go through 2 in order to appreciate 3. So people saw 2 and said, oh, this isn't as happy as the first one, so never mind, let's not go see 3. Now, if you watch it as a trilogy, you know, and you have the time and stamina, you can see how
perfectly,
you know, structured and calculated everything is. You know?
So, okay, so there's just one particular... I mean, first of all, I do want to talk about the fact that... Would you say that your craft as a craftsman, your talent was always there, but your craft developed over these years from... I mean, you know, we see a different cinematographer from Halloween to The Thing to Back to the Future. It's, you know... is it just the budget that got bigger, or was it also your...
No, I think, you know, there are certain things that I've always kind of felt, which is you learn more from your mistakes than you do from
successes
or accidentally doing something right and not knowing, you know, what it is you did.
Right.
You know, you just, sometimes you're lucky. Sometimes you say, oh, yeah, that was very clever of me. But, and it's one of the things I've always been tolerant of the crew, you know, because a guy will come and say, oh, you know, I did this and it ruined this, and I'll say, oh, that's okay. We know not to do that again. As opposed to saying you're fired.
Right.
Because, you know, you can sense when somebody will learn
from the mistake.
Right. So I've always felt that, and I've tried to learn from my mistakes and from the things that worked out. You know, that's why you go and watch the editor work, and you say, oh, I see. When those didn't cut together, I should have done this. The lighting, you know, if I could have been a little faster had I done this. You know, so you're always learning in this business. And I think that's one of the key things, you know, to always remember. And the fact that I've been very fortunate to work on innovative films.
Right.
Films, and I think that because if I've done something that was new and unusual, it allowed me the credibility to try something else, new and unusual.
Right.
So, you know, you look at the various things. Roger Rabbit was, you know, one of the last pencil on paper, ink and paint on cells, animation films made. The technology was, you know, kind of simplistic. Now you can do computer-generated anything, and the characters can handle, you know, objects and live in this, you know, live-action world. In those days, everything was, we had to manipulate the props and find ways to hide. You know, you didn't have wire removal and rig removal and all of the things that a computer allows you to do now. You had to manipulate an object, puppeteer it, in such a way that they could cover the rod or whatever held it with the animated character. It required a great deal of thought, great deal of technique, great deal of everything. And it's one of the hazards, I think, of what we do. You know, Jurassic Park, the very first movie that used photorealistic computer-generated creatures.
Yeah.
Nobody had
done the entire country with their jaws to their
right.
chest
in theaters. And now, you know, you can do that in your, you know, basement.
$4.95 with the software you stole.
Exactly. Yeah. With, you know, a Mac and, you know, a little bit of intelligence and talent.
Right.
But in those days, you couldn't do it. So, you know, there's kind of a sense of satisfaction in Roger Rabbit and Casper and you know, Jurassic Park and all these various films that did one step more, even Apollo 13, you know, and films like that.
I was going to ask about Apollo 13, but before we move on to Apollo 13, you... Oh, I thought you were trying to give me a high five.
No.
So, on Back to the Future, I just want to ask about one little thing and mm-hmm. say, how did you do it? How did you have to put that together, special effects-wise and photography-wise?
Mm-hmm.
And how would you do it today? Which is, Doc showing Marty about, you know, how the machine works, the DeLorean works. He lines up, I think it's Oscar is the name of the dog?
Einstein. Mm-hmm. Right.
I forget I said that. He lines up Einstein, the dog, in the mm-hmm. DeLorean, and holds Marty there by the scruff of his neck while the car comes rushing towards them, and then mm-hmm. all of a sudden, whoosh, we have the blaze of flames as the, mm-hmm. the car disappears. How did you shoot that then?
Well, we went out to the mall,
yeah.
had a car, the DeLorean,
yeah.
drive at presumably 88 miles an hour,
right.
probably closer to about 30 or 40. But,
right.
And it would zoom past the camera. And then we had visual effects, or a special effects guy, Kevin Pike, who would, he had built this rig that sprayed a flammable liquid on the pavement and light it, and those tire tracks were actual real flames that spread out across the... Then we shot Marty and Doc on a blue screen,
yep.
so they could be composited into that shot. So in other words, you know, they end up being essentially like if you had a photograph and you cut it out and glued it down on top of a background.
Right.
Well, we do the equivalent, but with film in motion. And so they were done with a blue screen and then composited with a, in that time, an optical printer, which
right.
was a very complex mechanical device. Now you can do it again in your basement with Mac for $4.95.
Right.
But in those days, it was a complex kind of thing. Roger,
don't forget the stolen software.
Well, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why it's only $4.95. But you know, in those days, it took quite a bit of craft.
Right.
You know, shooting blue screens on a big stage with a blue screen behind it, and proper lighting that had to accomplish and accommodate the requirements of the technical stuff, and then all of those elements are combined into a visual duplicate negative by putting it through this, you know, physical device, the optical printer, and so forth and so forth. It was, you know, once again a technical, you know, accomplishment to
right.
to be able to do that kind of thing. Now, you know, you'd have several options, which are things like you would, you know, just shoot them reacting at the mall, And then the visual effects people would add the flames,
right?
Which would probably be not real flames, but, you know, just computer digital flames.
Yeah.
And you'd build a digital car, you know, so that as they do very much, you know, pretty commonly now for car commercials and stuff, you know, they're digital cars, and they look pretty real. Action films require a tremendous amount of digital
assets.
Cars and, yeah. and things that roll and blow up right next to the star that you wouldn't dare put a rolling, blowing up car next to.
Whereas when you were starting out, you'd think nothing about killing a star.
It was the price of success.
I
rely now. My career is built around how many guys I killed.
Right, with rolling cars.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, but anyway.
Those were the good old days, though, right?
You know, there was no lawyers, insurance companies, any of that stuff. But anyway, you know, so now that kind of stuff, which is why films have become big, elaborate, you know, comic book and right. action adventure.
Right, right.
Because...
Do you miss the practical stuff?
Well, to a certain extent, yeah, because, you know, yes, it's easier, you know, and sometimes more effective to do it digitally. But... you know, with that comes the price of often that it's all about the spectacle and not so much about the characters and the story and so forth, you know. So, you know, you look at the history of film and early films, the 40s and so forth, were all about characters and story. That's the movies they made. Once in a while, you know, a Western or something, but very little science fiction, you know.
Right.
Now, you know, it's all about the spectacle and the science fiction and the fantasy and stuff, and less about the characters and stuff. You know, there's an awful lot of films that people now are complaining that they don't feel empathy for the characters, but they do like to go see, you know, spaceships blow up and things like that.
So, first of all, I'm loving your responses to these things. It's fabulous. It's perfect for this. The problem is that I don't want to keep you here too long. And you've done so many movies that we can talk about. Just moving on to one more picture. Well, two more pictures that I'd like to ask about: Apollo 13 and Jurassic Park. Out of order, obviously. Jurassic Park was 93, and Apollo 13 was, I think, 95.
Mm-hmm.
But the okay, well, you're shooting Jurassic Park, and so much of it is set in this lush, green backdrop, and then so much of it is this whole buildup of the night exteriors that lead to the T-Rex being, you know, taken out.
Mm-hmm.
Is this your first time working with Steven Spielberg as a director, by the way?
No.
You done Hook?
I'd done Hook before with him directing, and then he'd been the producer on... the Back to the Futures and Casper and various films. So,
working with him as a director, though, is
I had a relationship, you know, sort of a semi-professional relationship because he was the producer. So of course, you know, he would look at dailies and we would talk. He'd come visit the set and stuff. But I was quite delighted when he called me and said, "Would I like to do Hook?"
Right.
And I said, "Yeah," because it was a fantasy and. You know, all the stuff that I really enjoy doing. Very challenging because the sets were huge.
Yep.
Tree. You know, the it was very stylized, a little theatrical, you know, which is something.
The whole dancing up to the boat, where's the hook, where's
right.
the
hook. Yeah. So I enjoyed that very much. And at the end of it, he said, it's been fun working. And I thought, well, this is goodbye. And he said, so I'm going to do this little dinosaur movie, this action film, you know, and Hook was such a big production that Steven was determined that this next little dinosaur movie, it was just a, you know, action adventure movie, was going to be done on time and responsibly and on schedule and budget and all of that stuff.
So just to pick up on one thing you said, he said, well, it's been nice working with you, and you thought, well, that's that.
Well,
I mean, did you really get the sense at that point?
No, because you sort of understand, you know, whether it's successful or not. We didn't fight. We didn't, you know, working with Stephen is, you know, he's the consummate visual storyteller. You know, right. If you look at his movies, the camera is always doing something that creates the emotion, and you know, so he is. I delight in watching his films. You know, the one that's coming out next, Lincoln, looks like it's going to be a fascinating character portrayal with visuals.
Right.
So he does that. So, you know, I was constantly aware of the fact that he is using the camera, you know, which is, again, one of the things I enjoy doing the most, finding angles and shots that, you know, move you and so forth. So when we were doing Hook, we had apparently a good time, and he said he wanted me to do this little
dinosaur picture. Little dinosaur picture.
Which, as I say, he was determined that it was going to be done on schedule and budget.
Right.
And he was very careful. The genesis of this whole thing was that originally the dinosaurs were going to be stop motion or go motion. In other words,
really?
Rubber miniatures.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you set up a camera and you light this thing, and then you do one frame, click, and then you move the arm a little bit and you go click, and then you move the arm and the head a little bit and you go click, and then you move the arm and the head and the jaw a little bit and you go click, and then you move the leg
and
a little bit.
This should take you at least 18 months.
Wait, I'm not done yet. Yeah, and then you move the tail a little bit and you go click, and then you know. Anyway, it's I can't understand how those guys can possibly. Yeah. Do that, and
makes you want to hug the guys. Do walls.
Yeah. But you know, if you make a little mistake and you move the leg backwards instead of forwards for some reason, and you look at it, you say, "Oh no, I got to do the whole shot over again." So that was going to be the process, and the animator was Phil Tippett, who is one of the very best in stop motion or go motion. Creatures, little rubber things. You know, he did the Pillsbury Doughboy and all that stuff. So we're prepping the film, and it's determined that we can do on the budget about 150 of these dinosaur shots. And Stephen was determined.
Ranging in length from 3 seconds to
3 to 5 seconds is the basic shot length of something like that.
Right.
And so it was going to be 150 of those. And as we would be storyboarding and production meetings and prepping the film, Stephen would say, okay, so, and then here's a shot. The dinosaur does this, and he grabs this. How many shots is that? And somebody would say, oh, that's 152. He'd say, oh, no. Okay, so let's see what we can eliminate. And he would go back, you know, and very carefully budget himself for the 150 shots.
This is something that people need to hear. That you're talking about a master filmmaker, height of his game,
right?
And learning. He's still trying to
still trying to yeah, get the most out of it and be a responsible filmmaker. Because right. You know what we do in making a film is not just we go out and do what we want, but you have to learn to juggle how to do it within a certain time limit and for a certain budget.
Right.
So Stephen was very responsible about that. Well, as we're just in the prep, and he's talking about how many shots, Dennis Muren from Industrial Light and Magic, George Lucas's special effects company, comes to a meeting and he says, you know what? We can do this in the computer, we think. And everybody says, oh, really? Well, let's see the, you know, your test.
You
say, well, we don't have any yet, but next week. So, goes away, comes to the production meeting the next week, and there's some video of a dinosaur wireframe moving. Now, wireframe is, you know, you've probably seen them. It's the dinosaur or any creature, that's just made up of white lines that shows the shape.
The exterior.
They're, and no skin, nothing, just white lines, you know, the grid of the shape. And it's running. And you look at it and say, well, that looks pretty real. That's a good run. You sense the weight physics of the tail, you know, and the head moving. You say, that's really good. Stephen says, well, now let's see what it looks like with the skin on it. And they say, oh, well, you haven't done that yet. But
But you're getting closer to shooting the movie at this point.
He said, I'll be right back. So a week later, he brings one, and it's got a gray skin. It looks like it's made out of clay, but it doesn't have the wire lines. It has a gray skin. And he shows it, and here's this thing running, and it's got weight and all that stuff. And Steven says, wow, that looks really good. What about the skin? And they said, wait right here. I'll be right back. So a week later, he comes back, and now there's a skin on it. But it's kind of flat.
Right. The lighting is flat.
Yeah. So wait right here. I'll be right back. A week later, they come back, and it's lit. It runs through some shadows and stuff. And Steven says, okay, you convinced me. We'll commit to this. So, throw away the rubber miniatures, and everyone says, well, what about Phil Tippett? He was going to do the animation. He said, well, he's going to learn, you know, this computer stuff, and he's going to animate it. And we all said, oh, great, because he was the consummate stop motion animation guy.
Right.
So, we started the movie without knowing whether it would really work.
Right.
But we were all dedicated to making it work. So we devised all these tricks, and about half of it is rubber puppets.
Right.
So the task of the CG guys, the computer guys, was to make the computer stuff match the real-life puppets, which had skin and texture and lighting and all that stuff. So I would light it for the best look on the rubber, which requires what I had learned on the thing, which is you don't just flat light it. You've got little spots and
contour
reflections. And so and then the CG guys did an amazing job of matching to the puppets, you know, the rubber creatures.
Now, there were still some actual practicals used, like when Jeff Goldblum was leaning on the... the one that's the whatever dino it is that's fallen over and is sick, and also the head
stegosaurus,
and then there was the raptor in the kitchen scene, that famous kitchen sequence with all
that's
the steel.
One of my favorite sequences in that movie and almost any movie I've done.
Explain why that is one of your favorite sequences.
Well, it is the quintessential combination of the computer, the rubber, the storytelling, and all of these other technicalities that aren't necessarily obvious.
Yeah.
Things like the kitchen was made out of brushed stainless steel.
Yes.
Brushed stainless is a unique surface material in that no matter where you put a light, it is reflected, unlike a mirror.
Right.
You know, you can put a light in a particular place, you see it in the mirror, and you put it, move it just a little bit, it's gone.
But with brushed stainless steel, reflection somewhere.
Because it's made up of these, you know, scratches and prisms, and no matter where you are, there's a surface that'll reflect the light. So anywhere we'd put a light, there would be reflected, and it was distracting. But you need the lights to light the people. You need the lights to light the walls and so forth. So it was this technical dance.
Jigsaw puzzle almost?
Of where to put a light to light the character, but putting up huge black things to, you know, block the reflections.
Mm-hmm.
And then another little light that would bring, you know, the surface to life, but not very much. You know, and you're trying to light the people. Then the puppets were added to that, so you had to light the puppets, but you didn't want to have the chrome reflect and the stainless reflect. You know, and so it was a very, very technical process with the puppets, and then the computer generated stuff. And then than what I had learned on Roger Rabbit, which is to make, you know, non-real world creatures part of the real world, you get them to interact with it. So, you know, I would have suggestions about when he jumped up that they would knock a whole bunch of stuff off the top. So we would we would pull things off of the, you know, the countertop with monofilament, and then the animators would put the foot on that. And, you know, so you got this sense that these non-existent creatures were interacting with the real world. So,
fabulous.
Combining all of this stuff with the rubber creatures, the CG creatures, the technical difficulties of just shooting in there, creating the camera moves, you know, it was you know, to me, one of the great challenges of that film. And it's very effective because, you know, you get completely sucked into the kids having to escape these, you know, lethal creatures, and how are they going to do it, and you know, the girl outsmarting them with the reflection, and all of the things that that make that such a complete filmic experience, not only making it, but as a result for the audience.
Fantastic. Okay. What I'm going to suggest we do is I'm going to ask you some unrelated questions now about other cinema, because one of the things we're going to do is create retrospectives of photographers with photographers talking about other photographers. And then we'll call it a night because you are wiped out, and so well, I know I am, because you know, I'm shooting 16-hour days. But more importantly, you know, I think I'd love to come back and do this again and keep going, because you just got so much to talk about. That being said, I'll call out the name, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on the on the photographer, the man we met with a little while ago, Gordon Willis.
Oh, Gordon is you know, you have to look at his work and say, what great graphic storytelling, you know, what interesting use of the camera, you know, and his work with Woody Allen was, you know, is stuff that you hold up as being, you know, quintessential Woody Allen, great Gordon Willis stuff, the stuff he did with, you know, Coppola, the Godfather, great images that are so, you know, mood creating. And emotional, you know, attachment to the characters. You know, the dark eyes, the light that goes overhead on Marlon Brando.
Yes.
You know, and how the compositions are all such great. You know, just the history of visual storytelling.
Was there any other ones that were some of your favorites?
Well, Conrad Hall was a great effect on my my sensibilities, my career. I was a new cinematographer. I'd come out of UCLA Film School.
In Cold Blood? Just a guess.
Yeah. And I was doing a little movie. And I needed to know about day for night, a technique of you know, creating the illusion of nighttime, but you shoot it during the day. And The Professionals that Connie had shot was one of my favorite movies. It was a very clean, evocative. The visuals were great. So I called where he was working on Day of the Locust, the stage, and I said, you know, brashly, as a young filmmaker, is Conrad Hall there? And some guy who had answered, who was a grip or whatever, said, yeah, Connie's here, yeah. And I said, can I talk to him? Hey, Connie, you got a phone call. Right? So I thought, oh, my God, what am I going to do now? Right. So he came to the phone, yeah. And I said, hi. So listen, you don't know me. I'm this film, you know, new guy, and I was a film student. I have some questions. He said, oh, okay, listen, I can't talk too much on the phone. why don't you come down to the studio
down to the set.
And we'll talk a little bit. And so I went down to Paramount.
Wow.
And I went on the stage. He called in a pass. And I went to the stage, and I said, hi, I'm here to see Mr. Hall. And the guy said, he's over there. So I went over, and I said, hi, I'm the guy who called on the phone. He said, yeah, okay, just a minute. And, okay, put a light there. So he said, come on over here. So we sat down in chairs probably half an hour.
Wow.
He just shared with me, you know, his experiences and how to do stuff. And very, very, you know, and that's one of the things I think is interesting about what we do and working, you know, my colleagues and, you know, there isn't the sort of jealousy about somebody. You know, we offer each other help with suggestions and experiences and stuff. And I was so impressed by the fact that here's this guy who was, you know, well known at the time. He certainly became even more so. Who was willing to tell some, you know, young kid the secrets of the craft. And I understand in the early days, you know, the special effects guys and the cinematographers and all would jealously guard the special lens that they used on the girl to make her look good.
Or the filter.
Or, the filter and the you know, special effects guys wouldn't tell about the, you know, the mixture to make the flames really big, whatever it was. And you know, I think that cinematographers, because we are always solving the same kinds of issues and you know, using equipment that's new and so forth, that there's a camaraderie, you know, of guys and a shared appreciation as opposed to a jealousy about somebody. So Connie, you know, really showed that to me when I went to him, and it's been one of those things that I said, you know what, I was so appreciative of that, and the fact that I learned from James Wong Howe at UCLA, he just came and told us how to do it, showed us how to do it, made us do it by being crew members, that I said, you know, what a great thing, anytime I can pass that on, give back, I will do it.
Fantastic. What was it about, just before we wrap up, what was it about Conrad Hall's photography that you admired so much? I mean, obviously he made stunning images and everything he did right up to World Perdition, his last picture. But
I think the thing about his work was he was never oppressively stylistic. You know, he had a clean style. It always served the production, you know, it was sophisticated. And that's something I've always, you know, tried to do, was to make the work sophisticated, not try to impose, you know, one style on everything I do, you know, and that's, you know, sometimes a handicap because, you know, you don't get noticed for your style. But I've always felt that you don't want the audience to be aware of the visuals. Yes, it's possible to create stunning visuals, and sometimes you do that. Period films, you know,
right.
You know, will create, you know, visual beauty. But you know, there are other films that should just suck the audience into the story and not, you know, be the kind of thing where they would say, oh my gosh, look at this image, you know. Yes, sometimes you do that because that's what that moment is about. You know, the characters are in a beautiful environment, so you make it beautiful for the audience. Other times they're in a grungy environment and you make it grungy for the audience, you know. So to me, Connie did that. You know, they were always served the story. And yet they were sophisticated.
Dean Cunningham, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
It's a real pleasure to have you. Your generosity and your spirit brings that.
Well, I recently heard something
that
was meaningful to me. And it actually comes from musical I had just seen in New York. It's wonderful when the life you wish for comes true.
Yes.
I've been fortunate.
Well, we've been fortunate to have some of your images.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Mm-hmm.